This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Financial markets around the world seem calmer today after plummeting last week, then zooming back up on Friday when the U.S. Federal Reserve cut a key interest rate. The housing market still appears to be the epicenter of the crisis, but concerns about credit go much wider and much deeper. And to describe the situation as confusing seems to be an understatement. Today we'll try to sort out what this means and how it could affect you. Later, today's boom and bust cycle from lots of easy credit is not just a recent phenomenon. It goes back to the country's founding. And we'll talk with a tourist-turned-hurricane watcher in Mexico. But first, questions and answers on the markets. If you have questions about the turmoil on Wall Street, give us a call. We'd especially like to hear from listeners who've been affected by the credit crunch. Is it getting harder to borrow money for your home or your business? 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. And the comment on our blog, if you'd like, npr.org/blogofthenation. Joining us now is Martin Cossette. He has a three-bedroom home he and his wife bought 3 years ago in Meriden, Connecticut, is now in foreclosure. He's with us on the line from Oakville, Connecticut, and thanks very much for being with us today.
You're welcome.
And this was your first home, I understand?
Yes, it was.
And you stretched yourself financially like a lot of people who buy their first home.
Absolutely.
What happened?
We were told it was not a problem. We started looking late 2003, early 2004. Our lease was coming up on the apartment we were rented. We had rented for the previous 3 years, and we decided it was time to start looking for a house because our son was getting on. He was almost three. He was 2.5 at the time. So we decided to take the plunge and get into our own house, and we found a mortgage broker who seemed too good to be true, but we called them a few times, and they were good at the time.
At the time. It was a $180,000 loan. That covered the entire price of the house, right?
That's right.
And so you now find yourself in a crisis. You were making the payments for a while, but then the payments went up.
Absolutely. Well, we refinanced on our own because what we were told at the time we started looking around and what we actually ended up with, we were told we could get a fixed rate, 30-year mortgage, not a problem. You know, our credit wasn't the best in the world, most first-time buyers, but it was what it was. So
after the first couple of years, when the adjustable rate mortgage was starting to adjust, they said, well, don't worry about that. When that time comes, you can get a fixed rate loan. Don't worry about it.
Well, what we tried to do was we tried to hedge that. We tried to head that off because it was coming due. The two-year time period was actually coming due the following late 05, we started seeing the interest rates starting to climb, and my wife and I said, gee, let's take a look now.
Mm-hmm.
We have a prepayment penalty. Let's take a look and see what we can refinance for now and maybe lock in a better rate, because why wait till the end of March in 4 months in 2006? And who knows what the interest rate was going to be at that time, because at that time the interest rates, like I said, were going up gradually, almost 0.25% every couple of weeks. So what we did was we called around and we found a mortgage company who said, not a problem, prepayments are always part of the deal. They always will factor it in. That's not a deal, not a deal breaker. So the house that was valued at $180,000 in April of 2004 suddenly was worth now $230,000 in December of 2005, because that's what we needed to make the mortgage work to pay off our credit card debt and roll in everything into a nice, convenient payment.
Mm-hmm. And
that's another issue, too.
Yeah, that's another issue, too. But nevertheless, things got out of control.
Absolutely. And, you know, we went from, let me see, I have the numbers right here. We went from a first mortgage payment of $897,000. On the first mortgage, because the first time we bought the house in March of 04, they actually had to give us two mortgages.
Mm-hmm.
80% went towards the first mortgage and 20% went towards a second mortgage for the balance.
Right.
So we were paying approximately $1,150 a month, roughly here. I'm looking at the numbers. And then when we refinanced in December of 05, our payments jumped to almost $2,100 a month, but it was supposedly a fixed rate, and we were supposedly better off. Now, again, we were told time and time again, even when we signed our first mortgage papers, don't worry, make it through 2 years, you'll be fine, the interest rates will fall, you can come back and refinance at a later, you know, in 2 years, you'll be fine. We were told that when we refinanced the second time. They said, make it through 5 years, have a good payment. I mean,
mm-hmm.
the mortgage companies would have had us paying for an eternity because we would have kept refinancing every 5 years had we listened to them.
Yeah. And after all this experience, do you feel like, did you know what you were doing?
We thought we did, but we also thought, too, that the people who were supposedly our mortgage broker who had an interest in helping us, that so we thought at the time, and even the lawyer who attended the closing on our behalf, we found that was really part of the mortgage broker's lawyer as well, so there was a conflict of interest.
Mm-hmm.
And we found this all out after the fact. We thought we had done our homework, but obviously, in looking back in retrospect, we didn't do nearly enough as we thought we should have.
And having been bruised by all of this, you've lost the house. It's being foreclosed on. You're back in a rental unit.
Yes.
Going to try it again anytime soon?
Only after my attorney, Neil Crane, as one of the first things he said when we presented this to him back late last year, he said, "How much did you put down on the house?" And we said zero. He said, "Absolutely not." He said, any of his clients, he recommends 20% down, the old standard rule.
Mm.
And that's what it should be. Unless the day comes when we have 20% in the bank of whatever our house that we'd like to purchase, we won't touch it. If it's 19%, we'll not touch it. We have learned that hard, fast rule.
It's going to make it harder for people to buy houses.
Well, in retrospect, in reality is, it should be. Like I've said this before, I've had this conversation numerous times with people talking about this in the past few weeks. It is far easier right now, at least in this state of Connecticut, to get a house than it is to purchase an automobile or even use your department store credit card.
Hmm.
You can get a pre-approval letter for, like we were pre-approved, I believe it was almost $300,000. They faxed the letter over to our house so we could show interested realtors when we were looking at houses that we were pre-approved, and it took them less than an hour to finance a car that's $15,000 to $20,000 relative terms.
Yeah,
could take you upwards of a day and a half, and you have to keep going back with further and further documentation. I mean, it's almost ludicrous to walk around this country with a letter of credit in your pocket, almost for a pre-approval letter, to get a house for $300,000 and basically, you can close in less than a week.
Martin Crosette, good luck to you. Thanks very much for sharing your story.
Thank you.
Martin Crosette with us from Oakville in Connecticut. Joining us now is Stephen Perlstein, a business writer for The Washington Post. He's at a studio over at the newspaper, and nice to have you on the program today.
Good afternoon.
And that story we heard from Martin Crosette is sadly altogether too familiar one. How did the problems of people like him and the companies and that made loans to him, how did that shake out into a problem that has now shaken Wall Street?
Well, the reason is partly having to do with the structure of the industry now, which you saw, we heard about one end of it.
Sure.
He didn't say, "I went to my bank and I knew the banker and the banker knew me and the banker knew the street where I was going to buy the house. And they made the loan and then the bank held the loan. And when we got in trouble, we went and saw the bank and we worked something out." Notice that story didn't happen. And the reason is because within minutes of his broker having arranged a mortgage for him with a mortgage company, a lender, that loan was probably sold. The broker got paid in full. The mortgage lender sold the loan, got paid in full the fee. They're working for fees here.
Mm-hmm.
And we can talk about how they calculate those fees later if you'd like.
Okay.
And then that was sold to an investment bank. And the investment bank took that mortgage with a bunch of other mortgages and packaged it up, went to Fannie Mae and got an insurance for it, and then sold it to – basically used it as the assets backing a bond and sold the bond to investors. You know, thousands of investors, could be individuals, mm-hmm. but probably wasn't. It was probably a pension fund or a hedge fund, some other institutional investor. And that's where the mortgage is, or maybe not. Maybe, in fact, that bond was taken and by another investment banker and packaged with a bunch of other similar bonds, mortgage-backed securities bonds, And they became the assets for yet another bond, which was called a CDO, collateralized debt obligation, sometimes known as CDO. And it's quite possible, Neil, that the CDO was packaged with other CDOs and became the assets backing yet another security called CDO squared.
So what now, we've had is this. So as this goes on, Stephen Perlstein, the commodification of this debt has spread all throughout the financial system.
Okay, all throughout. And these packages are not necessarily sold as wholes. They're actually divided. Some of these CDO packages, some even of the mortgage-backed securities, the first of the packages, are sliced into what's called tranches. And I won't go into it, but basically that goes from the least risky tranche to the most risky tranche. And each tranche gets a different rating from the rating agencies. And so people who want to take the toxic tranches, those are the mm-hmm. most risky, those might go to hedge funds, and the safest ones might go to pension funds. And so who owns these things now? Who holds that fellow's mortgage? Well, a portion of it could be held anywhere, German banks, Australian hedge funds, rich Brazilians wanting to invest, certainly the Middle East bought a lot of these. The Bank of China, the Central Bank of China might be holding it. Who knows? The fact of the matter is that all along the way, very nice fees were earned by people who basically passed the hot potato along. And they didn't want to look too carefully because they were collecting fees. They had no residual interest in how the story turned out. Mm-hmm. And this, is turns out, has been the big weakness of what's called the securitization process. You call it commoditization process. Mm-hmm. But this is the big weakness, is it's a form of moral hazard, which is the person who's making the loan isn't responsible in the long run.
We're talking with Stephen Perlstein of the Washington Post about troubles in the markets and how it could affect you. If you have questions about where it all started, how far it could go, or what it means to you, you're having trouble getting money, 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. First, we heard that the housing market was slowing. Then Wall Street took a dive. Now the mortgage meltdown has spread to anybody who wants or has credit. Just today, the biggest mortgage lender in the country reportedly began to lay off workers. How far will it go? Does it affect you? If you've been caught up in the credit crunch, give us a call, 800-989-8255, or email us, talk@npr.org. Stephen Perlstein is with us. He's a business writer for the Washington Post. And let's see if we can get somebody on the line. And let's begin with, this is Jerry. Jerry's with us from Boise in Idaho.
Oh, hi. I'm not sure whether to be mad or just amazed. Carol and I, I retired 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, and we, in the meantime, had bought properties in Boise, and we sold both of our rentals, and we, just before this happened, we made a lot of money on it. But we were also planning to sell our home, which I currently have contractors in here all the time. You know, we're spending our money trying to do this, and suddenly I found out that I can't make an offer on a property in the next door county because I'm retired and everything else is going haywire, even though I've got enough cash probably to buy them,
mm-hmm.
buy it, but I can't get it, and all the buyers can't get any credit either. It seems to me like the solution is let's bail out the banks like we did the SNL and everybody else. But on the bottom end, where's the help in this? I mean,
mm-hmm. Well, let's
crying out loud, I'm stuck here now living in Boise, Idaho on a quiet street, now a highway. And I've already made these obligations to the contractors because they're going to upgrade this house that we
right.
live in. And I can't even find money for the buyers.
Right.
I can't get, because I'm retired under these really quick solutions, money to help me.
Well, let's talk about the first part of that with Stephen Pearlstein. And Stephen, I guess the first...
He kind of pointed out most of the problems.
But let me ask you, I mean, the first thing that happens, I guess, when people get scared about what's happening with all of these loans is that they're, I guess, money gets tighter. They have more strictures on who they're going to loan money to and how the conditions they're going to loan them on. Is that right, Stephen?
Well, the people at the end of that chain that I described no longer want to buy those securities. And they understand that 90, 95% of the mortgages in them might be fine. But they don't know that. And they now know that no one really gave them a good scrubbing. So the response to that is, I'll buy none of them. And as long as this, what's called the secondary market for mortgages, has essentially dried up, and it's not just prime subprime mortgages, it's all the way up to prime mortgages and jumbo primes, as long as that secondary market is dried up, that means the bank would have to make the loan, or the lender would have to make the loan and hold it. And here's another problem. Let's imagine that lender isn't a bank, but is Countrywide Mortgage, which actually owns a bank, but it's a small bank. And they say, well, you know, where am I going to get money? Well, they could actually go out and borrow money, except guess what? No one wants to lend them money either. And so there is a credit crunch in housing. But here's the thing. It's not just housing anymore. And it's not just housing because the same lenders who have got in trouble, the same securities holders, basically, now they don't want to buy any asset-backed mortgages because any asset-backed securities, whether they're backed by credit card debt or receivables debt, they don't want any of it. And furthermore, many of the lending institutions like banks have decided they need to put more cash in their vault because people are coming in and they're not paying loans and other people are wanting loans. They need more cash. And so there's a reluctance to lend all through the system, and that's what we call a credit crunch. And it's basically the same as an old-fashioned bank run, only the bank isn't at the center of it anymore. What's at the center of it is a securities market where assets are bundled and used as collateral for securities, for bonds.
And let me ask you about another thing that Jerry was saying, and that was that, you know, gee, we need to bail these out so we can get the whole thing liquid again and moving again. But there's a lot of people who say, wait a minute, these companies had bad business practices. They deserve to be punished, and punishment for these companies going bankrupt, that's how the market corrects itself. That's how it makes changes.
Well, it's two parts of that. One is that nobody is proposing to bail out anybody who made a bad loan, a bad bet. But what happens in markets like these, as I just described, is people become irrational. And they don't distinguish the good loans from the bad loans. They just make no loans. And they dump the loans that they have indiscriminately. And that creates a real crisis because it has this domino effect that we've been talking about. And if you're the government, you say to yourself, that's going to if that persists, it's going to cause so much trouble for the economy, so much pain to people who had nothing to do with any of it, who don't need to be punished, who don't deserve to be punished, brings the economy to recession, that's overkill. And we have to be a little careful about saying that any time the government does anything to relieve this process, that it's a bailout. Nobody, and let me repeat this, nobody has ever at the moment proposed that the people who made bad loans be made whole in any way, shape, or form. So let's just calm down when we're talking about, oh, they're going to bail them out like this SNL crisis. You know, a lot of people lost a lot of money in the SNL crisis, including people who ran savings and loan institutions and who had invested in them. They were all wiped out by those. So there was some bailing out going on, but it was mostly of homeowners.
Am I done?
Jerry, I was just going to say thank you and good luck.
Am I done?
Are you done? No.
Well, no.
You know, you ought to go.
My question is, I really have assets and credit, and I'm stuck.
Well, you could use your cash.
I didn't do anything wrong. I've always paid 20% down and done all those things. But I see this as the people that make these cheap, whatever they are, unsecured, uncollateralized loans, punishing me. NIC, or Federal Reserve, I hate to say this because you said it was a bad word, but they are being bailed out.
No, they're trying to bail you out. That's the point.
I never took a bad loan in my entire life. Neither one of us did. Well, and I'm stuck.
Jerry, all I guess we can say at this point is good luck.
Oh, thank you. I need luck. Okay. Good or bad, right? Any luck's better than none.
Any luck at all.
What the Federal Reserve was trying to do was protect people like him, mm-hmm. who weren't involved in anything like that, by making more money available to his bank in Boise, whatever that is, mm-hmm. so that the Boise bank could go to the Federal Reserve, borrow some money, use his loan as collateral, borrow some money, and lend it to him. That's what the Federal Reserve did the other day when they lowered the discount rate and widened the number, the pool of assets that they would accept as collateral at the discount window. That's precisely what the Federal Reserve did. It did not try to bail out the person who held the mortgage of your first talker.
Right. Martin Cossette. Yeah.
Martin.
Here's an email we have from Patricia in Cincinnati. Doesn't it all this start with buyers being all too willing to spend money, more money than they can actually afford? While I acknowledge the reality that some lenders are indeed predatory, I still come back to this point. As a renter who feels I've been priced out of the housing market due to overeager buyers who've pushed prices to astronomical levels, I find it difficult to sympathize with people who I believe simply bought beyond their means.
Well, she's absolutely right, and she's on both points, and particularly that the abundance of cheap credit was an illusion. Because what happened is it made it seem like you could afford it, except that it made the house unaffordable for the next guy because you bid up. Everyone was bidding up the prices of houses to unsustainable levels, and so. If there was a perception on the part of people, well, all of a sudden everyone can afford houses, well, maybe they couldn't. Mm. And now we're coming back to that reality, which is that you can't increase home ownership rate by 2, 3, 4 percentage points in a matter of a couple of years without there being a concomitant increase in national income, which there was not, a household income.
Right. Let's get Tim on the line. Tim's calling from San Francisco.
Your last emailer kind of stole a little bit of my thunder. But I have another question about the loans that were being lent to the subprime loan market. And along with all the loans that were being made, there were equity loans being made also in the market. And my question is, those subprime loans don't fall under the same category as a mortgage. Is that correct? Those equity loans, I should say. So what ends up happening, from what I understand, I'm not an extremely well-educated man. I'm not an economist by any means. But the secondary loans that were made, when the banks, the bank laws changed so that the mortgages can be forgiven by bankruptcy. But the equity loans that people have taken out on these houses, and sometimes up to 100% of the value of the home, from what I understand, those loans can be called on by the bank, and the people who took out those equity loans are now accountable for those loans, and they are not forgiven by bankruptcy. So the people who have these second loans are now accountable for them, and also they can have their wages furnished by the banks for those loans. Is that correct?
Stephen Perlstein, has he got that right?
Well, I'm not a bankruptcy lawyer, but I believe that if they signed personally as well as putting the house up as collateral, and many times you have to in a home equity loan, if you sign for it personally, then you may not be able to wipe that out through bankruptcy under the new law.
Now, so that leads a whole probably millions of Americans, basically, and I know this is going to sound kind of big, but it leads them into indentured servitude because now they lost their home that they have to live in. They have to re-rent a home to live in, and they also have to pay the banks back the bad loans that they, instead of, in the old days, the banks used to take some responsibility for the loan if it was a good or a bad loan. So, you know, these are predatory tactics. So who's coming out ahead are the banks who now hold these people accountable, not for the first loan, but for the second loan for the rest of their lives or well into their retirement. So we're going to have a bankrupted system for not in my opinion, not for the next 3 to 4 years or 7 years after the bankruptcy is wiped out, but for the next 20 to 30 years after these people have signed these huge equity loans on these houses also.
Is it that dire? Stephen Perlstein?
I don't know. I don't think so. You know, the bankruptcy process
is the
bankruptcy process has become obviously more lender friendly and borrower unfriendly. But the process still allows for people to make reasonable and requires people to make reasonable payments and allows the payments to be stretched out. The system isn't that bad. And to say, well, this is all the bank's fault. Well, I mean, as a previous emailer pointed out. You know,
takes two to tango.
It takes two to tango, and there's mutual responsibility here.
I completely agree. I'm a working class man. I'm a blue collar worker, and I live in San Francisco. And by no means can I afford $1 million fixer upper, which is what a fixer upper cost in San Francisco, $750 to $1 million to fix the house up.
Mm-hmm.
And I had people trying to extend me loans to buy these places. You know, saying, "Oh, it's a great dream. You know, you can rent it later." And you know, I didn't take the bait. So, you know, it does take two to tango, and I'm really surprised at the stupidity of so many people. But, you know, greed and stealing wins every time, I think.
Okay. Tim, thanks very much for the call.
Time.
All right. Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye.
We're talking with Stephen Perlstein of The Washington Post about the credit crunch in the housing market, but also spreading beyond that. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And I guess that's the next question, Steve Perlstein, is how far beyond housing is this going to go?
Well, right now, Neil, the big focus on the markets is not in mortgages, although that's still a big cloud hanging over the markets. But it's in the area called commercial paper, which is sort of short-term loans that lots of companies get to finance their ongoing operations. And because some of the issuers of commercial paper were mortgage lenders or people who lent to mortgage lenders or hedge funds, all of a sudden the entire market for commercial paper is now in trouble. And people are having, you know, people who issue these who borrow the money this way are having trouble rolling over these loans, and now they're having to go to their bank. Often when you get issue commercial paper, what you have is a bank backup, a line of credit backup, so that if you can't roll over the commercial paper, then you can go to your bank and say, well, it didn't work this time, so I need a loan.
Right.
And because so many people are going back to their banks and saying, look, I need to take advantage of that line of credit that you promised me, the banks need money. And so the banks are having to do two things. They're having to borrow more money, which is why the Fed did what it did the other day. But what it also means is they're cutting off new lending. And by cutting off new lending, of course, you're causing problems for the economy, like for the gentleman in Boise, who's a new borrower, except he can't get through the front door.
Now, it's widely expected. There was one of the rates was cut on Friday. Now, widely expected, the Fed may cut the actually more important rate when they meet, on September 18th?
Yeah, I wouldn't necessarily count on that, Neil. I mean, I know the markets are counting on it. There's a lot of wishful thinking on the part of the markets. The federal funds rate is the rate, it's more of a benchmark rate against which all sorts of rates elsewhere in the economy are set. But in an environment like this, Neil, it's not going to have that big of an effect. And that is because, if you notice, rates for other things are going all over the place. They're not following what the Fed benchmark is. That's what happens in a sort of normal, quiet time.
Mm-hmm.
You raise the Fed fund rate and every other rate goes up by that much. That's not happening now. Rates are bouncing all over the place. And I'm not sure that that's the right approach. There's still an inflationary problem. The Fed doesn't want to be seen as being pushed around by the markets. And frankly, I don't think that's the key question. The key question is how to get the credit crunch uncrunched. And lowering the federal funds rate is actually not a very precise instrument for doing that.
Stephen Perlstein, thanks very much for your time today. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Stephen Perlstein, a financial writer at the Wall Street Journal, and he joined us from a studio at the newspaper here in Washington, D.C. Coming up, this turmoil in the markets may not be all that unusual. Our next guest argues it's a throwback to this nation's economic roots, plus our own tourist-turned-weather-watcher, hurricane-watcher in Mexico. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.